Chapter 25. I Quit. Mac Hall's firing of Bruno hit Maine like an earthquake. It caused turmoil and dissension throughout the company. Bruno had his share of enemies, but even some of them were dismayed. To many employees, it was obvious that the motive had been jealousy. During discussions across the lunch table or around the coffee wagon, people often confided that they thought Hall felt threatened by this man who was more than 15 years his junior and who had taken the firm to new levels of profitability. Hall couldn't allow Bruno to go on looking so good, one man said. Hall had to know that it was just a matter of time before Bruno would take over and the old man would be put out to pasture. As if to prove such theories, Hall appointed Paul Priddy as the new president. Paul had been a vice president at Maine for years and was an amiable nuts-and-bolts engineer. In my opinion, he was also lackluster, a yes-man who would bow to the chairman's whims and would never threaten him with stellar profits. My opinion was shared by many others. For me, Bruno's departure was devastating. He had been a personal mentor and a key factor in our international work. Priddy, on the other hand, had focused on domestic jobs and knew little, if anything, about the true nature of our overseas roles. I had to question where the company would go from here. I called Bruno at his home and found him philosophical. "Well, John, he knew he had no cause," he said of Hall. "So I demanded a very good severance package, and I got it. Mac controls a huge block of voting stock, and once he made his move, there was nothing I could do." Bruno indicated that he was considering several offers of high-level positions at multinational banks that had been our clients. I asked him what he thought I should do. "Keep your eyes open," he advised. "Mac Hall has lost touch with reality, but no one will tell him so, especially not now, after what he did to me." In late March 1980, still reeling from the firing, I took a sailing vacation in the Virgin Islands. I was joined by Mary, a young woman who also worked for Maine. Although I did not think about it when I chose the location, I now know that the region's history was a factor in helping me make a decision that would start to fulfill my New Year's resolution. The first inkling occurred early one afternoon as we rounded St. John Island and tacked into Sir Francis Drake Channel, which separates the American from the British Virgin Islands. The channel was named, of course, after the English scourge of the Spanish gold fleets. That fact reminded me of the many times during the past decade when I had thought about pirates and other historical figures, men like Drake and Sir Henry Morgan, who robbed and plundered and exploited, and yet were lauded, even knighted, for their activities. I had often asked myself why, given that I had been raised to respect such people, I should have qualms about exploiting countries like Indonesia, Panama, Colombia, and Ecuador. So many of my heroes, Ethan Allen, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, Lewis and Clark, to name just a few, had exploited Indians, slaves, and lands that did not belong to them, and I had drawn upon their examples to assuage my guilt. Now, tacking up Sir Francis Drake Channel, I saw the folly of my past rationalizations. I remembered some things I had conveniently ignored over the years. Ethan Allen spent several months in fetid and cramped British prison ships, much of the time locked into 30 pounds of iron shackles, and then more time in an English dungeon. He was a prisoner of war, captured at the 1775 Battle of Montreal, while fighting for the same sorts of freedom Jaime Roldós and Omar Torrijos now sought for their people. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and all the other founding fathers had risked their lives for similar ideals. Winning the revolution was no foregone conclusion. They understood that if they lost, they would be hanged as traitors. Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, and Lewis and Clark also had endured great hardships and made many sacrifices. And Drake and Morgan? I was a bit hazy about that period in history, but I remembered that Protestant England had seen itself sorely threatened by Catholic Spain. I had to admit to the possibility that Drake and Morgan had turned to piracy in order to strike at the heart of the Spanish Empire, at those gold ships, to defend the sanctity of England, rather than out of a desire for self-aggrandizement. As we sailed up that channel, tacking back and forth into the wind, inching closer to the mountains rising from the sea, Great Thatch Island to the north and St. John to the south, I could not erase these thoughts from my mind. Mary handed me a beer and turned up the volume on a Jimmy Buffett song. Yet, despite the beauty that surrounded me and the sense of freedom that sailing usually brings, I felt angry. I tried to brush it off. I chugged down the beer. The emotion would not leave. I was angered by those voices from history and the way I had used them to rationalize my own greed. I was furious at my parents, and at Tilton, that self-righteous prep school on the hill, for imposing all that history on me. I popped open another beer. I could have killed Mac Hall for what he had done to Bruno. A wooden boat with a rainbow flag sailed past us, its sails billowing out on both sides, downwinding through the channel. A half dozen young men and women shouted and waved at us, hippies in brightly colored sarongs, one couple stark naked on the foredeck. It was obvious from the boat itself and the look about them that they lived aboard, a communal society, modern pirates, free, uninhibited. I tried to wave back, but my hand would not obey. I felt overcome with jealousy. Mary stood on the deck, watching them as they faded into the distance at our stern. "How would you like that life?" she asked. And then I understood. It was not about my parents, Tilton, or Mac Hall. It was my life I hated, mine. The person responsible, the one I loathed, was me. Mary shouted something. She was pointing over the starboard bow. She stepped closer to me. "Leinster Bay," she said. "Tonight's anchorage." There it was, nestled into St. John's Island, a cove where pirate ships had lain in wait for the gold fleet when it passed through this very body of water. I sailed in closer, then handed the tiller over to Mary and headed up to the foredeck. As she navigated the boat around Watermelon Key and into the beautiful bay, I lowered and bagged the jib and hauled the anchor out of its locker. She deftly dropped the mainsail. I nudged the anchor over the side. The chain rattled down into the crystal clear water, and the boat drifted to a stop. After we settled in, Mary took a swim and a nap. I left her a note and rowed the dinghy ashore, beaching it just below the ruins of an old sugar plantation. I sat there next to the water for a long time, trying not to think, concentrating on emptying myself of all emotion. But it did not work. Late in the afternoon, I struggled up the steep hill and found myself standing on the crumbling walls of this ancient plantation, looking down at our anchored sloop. I watched the sun sink toward the Caribbean. It all seemed very idyllic, yet I knew that the plantation surrounding me had been the scene of untold misery. Hundreds of African slaves had died here, forced at gunpoint to build the stately mansion, to plant and harvest the cane, and to operate the equipment that turned raw sugar into the basic ingredient of rum. The tranquility of the place masked its history of brutality, even as it masked the rage that surged within me. The sun disappeared behind a mountain-ridged island, a vast magenta arch spread across the sky. The sea began to darken, and I came face to face with the shocking fact that I, too, had been a slaver, that my job at Maine had not been just about using debt to draw poor countries into the global empire. My inflated forecasts were not merely vehicles for assuring that when my country needed oil, we could call in our pound of flesh. And my position as a partner was not simply about enhancing the firm's profitability. My job was also about people and their families, people akin to the ones who had died to construct the wall I sat on, people I had exploited. For 10 years, I had been the heir of those slavers who had marched into African jungles and hauled men and women off to waiting ships. Mine had been a more modern approach, subtler. I never had to see the dying bodies, smell the rotting flesh, or hear the screams of agony. But what I had done was every bit as sinister, and because I could remove myself from it, because I could cut myself off from the personal aspects, the bodies, the flesh, and the screams, perhaps in the final analysis, I was the greater sinner. I glanced again at the sloop where it rode at anchor, straining against the outflowing tide. Mary was lounging on the deck, probably drinking a margarita and waiting to hand one to me. In that moment, seeing her there in that last light of the day, so relaxed, so trusting, I was struck by what I was doing to her and to all the others who worked for me, the ways I was turning them into EHMs. I was doing to them what Claudine had done to me, but without Claudine's honesty. I was seducing them through raises and promotions to be slavers, and yet they, like me, were also being shackled to the system. They, too, were enslaved. I turned away from the sea and the bay and the magenta sky. I closed my eyes to the walls that had been built by slaves torn from their African homes. I tried to shut it all out. When I opened my eyes, I was staring at a large, gnarled stick, as thick as a baseball bat and twice as long. I leaped up, grabbed the stick, and began slamming it against the stone walls. I beat on those walls until I collapsed from exhaustion. I lay in the grass after that, watching the clouds drift over me. Eventually, I made my way back down to the dinghy. I stood there on the beach, looking out at our sailboat, anchored in the azure waters, and I knew what I had to do. I knew that if I ever went back to my former life, to Maine and all it represented, I would be lost forever. The raises, the pensions, the insurance and perks, the equity. The longer I stayed, the more difficult it was to get out. I had become a slave. I could continue to beat myself up as I had beat on those stone walls. Or I could escape. 2 days later, I returned to Boston. On April 1st, 1980, I walked into Paul Priddy's office and resigned.